We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is hour two of the show. My name is David Inge, and glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer. Jason Croft on the controls this hour. Kyle Mabry was on hour number one. And for this hour, we're happy to have as our guest Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family medicine physician at Carle in Urbana, and for quite a while has been with us every other month. It's always a Monday. To answer healthcare questions. And, throughout the year, from time to time, we have people who deal with particular parts of the body, but he's the guy that deals with the whole thing and deals with grown-ups and children and people with all sorts of health issues. So we built this into the schedule so that there would be this fairly regular opportunity to ask general healthcare questions. And so that's why we call it Talk to the Family Doctor. That's the idea. There are, of course, our limits as to what we can do because the doctor can't see you. But we do this to, give you a place to come and ask some basic questions, and he will do his best to help you out. So for questions, all you need to do is call us here in Champaign, Urbana, 333-9455. That's the local number. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And if you would like to send us an email, well, you can do that too. And that is will-talk@illinois.edu. At any point you have questions, you can give us a call. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, David. I'm glad to be back.
So it's been very hot summer, particularly about the last 5 weeks. It's been very hot. People who have to do things outside, physically exerting things, whether you're working, whether you're playing sports, whatever that is, are really conscious of it. And I think just recently here, actually, the pediatric association, the Association of Pediatricians, has really been talking about this issue as far as young athletes are concerned. And there has been some real concern about, kids working too hard and what you need to be watching for to make sure that they're okay, so now we're headed back to school, and maybe it already has started marching band and football and stuff. What sort of things particularly do you think parents need to keep in mind as they're trying to make sure that their kids are going to be okay when they're out there working hard and it's hot?
Absolutely. The number one thing is hydration. If you become dehydrated, your ability to then cool the body in response to the ambient temperature and the increased temperature that you experience as you exercise becomes really quite compromised, and that's when somebody's going to really suffer the full effects of the heat. So absolutely, number one thing is keep the fluids going. You almost can't take in too much if you're really exerting yourself in this hot, humid weather.
Okay. And there's all sorts of things that people can go out and buy. I think that the thing that has been said, over and over again is, well, basically what you really need to do is you need to drink water.
Right.
And that's good enough. You don't need to have all kinds of special stuff. Water is just fine.
The quote, special stuff, the sports drinks, such products have a little sugar in it for some energy. They have some salts to replace some of the stuff that's lost in the sweat. But generally speaking, if you're simply eating regularly, you're not going to be totally bodily depleted of your sodium and your potassium. So truly, the key part is to replace the fluid, which is just water.
Mm. The one thing I thought that was kind of interesting is apparently there has been a change in that the older policy of the Pediatric Association was that the feeling that children did not tolerate the heat as well as adults. Now what they're saying is, well, as long as kids are physically in good shape and they're provided with good hydration, so there's plenty of water for them to drink, there's really no difference. They deal with the heat just as well or just as badly as adults.
Correct. That is true.
Okay. Something else, we've talked to from time to time. I've raised this question because it has gotten some attention occasionally in media about whether or not people, generally speaking, have enough fluid intake and whether people drink enough water. And it seems like there has been some controversy about this, where someone says, oh, well, you really need to drink 8 big glasses of water a day, and somebody else says, well, no, wait a minute. You have to sort of consider all the fluid that you're getting.
It has to take into consideration the size of the individual and their activities. For any given person, and a very good sign of adequate hydration is if you're still urinating. If you're taking in too little fluid and, you know, it's been 4 or 5 hours and you still don't have the urge to urinate, then you are definitely dry. The other sign when you do urinate is if the urine is very darkly concentrated, if it's a sort of a deep yellowish brown kind of color, that's, again, an indication that there's not enough fluid there. If you're urinating every couple of hours and the urine itself is relatively clear, then you're very well hydrated and shouldn't run into a problem.
Yeah. That was, in fact, one recent thing I've read said that very thing, that's an easy way to tell whether you're hydrated well enough or not. In this particular article, though, I was really struck by, and I hope I'm remembering this right, I think that it said that, you know, the average person, if you're well hydrated and you're urinating as much as you should, puts out, was it 1.5 liters of urine in a day, essentially? That seemed like an awful lot to me.
Well, let's kind of try and calculate that. We consider, say, for a hospitalized patient, the bare minimum is 30 cc's an hour. Ideally, 60 cc's an hour. A liter should be being put out, you know, at least every 8 to 10 hours.
Oh, so in a day, 1.5 liters. Actually, that's what, you know, right. And I suppose most people, because you never really measure it, you right. really don't, you know, you would not have an idea how much there was. But right. that, in fact, is the right number. Okay,
yeah. And that assumes that you're not having some other extra special loss of fluid, which can occur in situations where people are hot and humid, because you literally can sweat out a tremendous amount of extra fluid and not necessarily be aware of it.
Yeah. Well, that's the issue with heat exertion, that you're perspiring, you know, the body perspires to cool itself off. So you can, that's the thing. You're losing moisture through perspiration. That's why you need to continue to replace it by having water. And
correct.
It could be also that if you don't feel like the sweat is just running off of you, you might not be thinking about the fact that in fact you're continuing to lose moisture.
Right.
Okay. Well, other questions about that or anything else, whatever's on your mind, healthcare questions, give us a call. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Another one of the things that we have talked about a lot and continues, I suppose, in some people's minds to be an issue of some controversy is childhood vaccinations. And I was also really struck by a recent story here about that would say, you know, helps you make the point that it's really important. And that was that during the time now that we have been vaccinating kids for chickenpox, that the number of children dying as a result of chickenpox, it's virtually gone down to nothing.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
And I guess the one thing that really struck me about that was the idea that someone could die from chickenpox. Mm-hmm. What's the incidence of fatality related to chickenpox?
It's actually very rare, but chickenpox itself was so common that something that occurs only, you know, 1 in a million times actually would show up in the United States several different times during the year, simply because there are millions of children. And if everybody was getting chickenpox, there was always that sort of 1 in a million case where somebody either got varicella pneumonia or encephalitis. And those two were really quite serious complications of chickenpox. Unfortunately, because it was such a common sort of childhood rite of passage, you know, people used to think, well, everybody got chickenpox and everybody got over it and it was like no big deal. And, you know, 99% of the time that was true. But anything that occurs that commonly is going to have a potential problem, even if the side effect is rare. So there were cases, just like with the polio vaccinations. It used to be a live virus vaccination, and it got to the point where the only cases of polio were actually in children who got the live virus and came down with a case of polio. Mm-hmm. Again, very, very rare occurrence, maybe a half a dozen cases a year in the entire country. But that led to a switch to an inactivated polio virus so that nobody can get polio from the vaccination anymore. And again, it's just a matter of is the illness and potential complications of that illness common enough to warrant vaccinating everybody, especially if there's no downside to the vaccination. Mm. So in this particular case, the chickenpox vaccination has been very well tolerated, and we don't see the complications from it, from the disease anymore that we used to.
Okay. We have a caller. Others are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family medicine physician at Carl in Urbana. And so we're open to general sorts of healthcare questions. Whatever's on your mind, you can call us. Here's a caller here in Champaign County, here where we are, line one. Hello.
Hi. Two questions, I guess. I don't know if this is something you can answer, but I was just wondering about the general state of MRSA and the antibiotics that are available for treatment of resistant strains that we've got going around now. Something general on that, and then more specifically on the shingles vaccination. I think I'm a good candidate for getting it, and just heard about another friend who's come down with it. And I know there's a little controversy about any vaccination, but I know they don't. Last I heard, they don't claim a high, a particularly high effectivity. But apparently, if it doesn't stop you from getting shingles, the vaccination can make the outbreak less bad. And so, a couple things on that.
Correct.
I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. Thank you.
Two good questions. The caller referred to MRSA, M-R-S-A, which is methicillin-resistant staph aureus. Staph is a particular kind of bacteria that actually is quite commonly carried on the surface of people's skin. And as long as it remains on the surface, it doesn't generally cause a problem. But if there's a break in the skin, you can end up with an infection that starts there. And potentially, if it gets severe, can invade into the tissues deeper, can potentially get into the bloodstream, can then obviously be distributed anywhere in the body. The methicillin-resistant part is an indicator that it is not sensitive to the penicillin-type antibiotics or other antibiotics that work like penicillin. And in the past, a lot of common infections could be treated with penicillin and its derivatives, and that's not the case here because it simply is resistant. It has genetically been modified by time and exposure to antibiotics to be resistant to penicillin. So in these particular cases, if somebody has an infection and it's cultured, you grow it in the lab itself will test the particular bacteria against a variety of different antibiotics and find out which ones are in fact effective against that particular specimen. And then the patient can be prescribed that particular medication, and in most instances that will help clear it up. Though if you have a localized infection, what people would refer to as a boil or an abscess, the very best treatment is to actually physically drain it, open it up, get it to basically clean out, and in combination with some antibiotics. But it's becoming actually much more common. It used to be thought to be just a type of infection that was picked up in the hospital setting, where lots of antibiotics are used for lots of different purposes and very resistant types of bacteria could be harbored. But now we're finding a lot more cases of MRSA in the general community in otherwise healthy individuals. Fortunately, there are still a variety of antibiotics that are, in fact, effective against it, but it points out part of the process is as we use more and more antibiotics for different things, bacteria that actually survive those antibiotics become resistant to it, and then we have a whole new generation of different types of infections, and the pharmaceutical companies have to come up with a new generation of antibiotics to cover those particular types. And so it's an ongoing battle, one that in some instances we're just sort of barely staying ahead of. But in this particular case, if somebody has a localized infection, a boil or an abscess, seeing their physician, getting it drained, culturing it, and establishing which antibiotics would be most effective is the usual treatment. Now, in somebody who is very, very ill, this particular type of bacteria would need to be treated in the hospital with intravenous antibiotics. Moving on to the second question about the shingles vaccination. Shingles in and of itself is the name of the disease process that we give to the reactivation of the chickenpox virus. So this goes back to our previous conversation. Generally speaking, when you had chickenpox, you get over the rash and then you feel better, but the virus doesn't necessarily leave your body. It actually resides in nerve roots in our body. And as long as your immune system is competent, it will suppress that virus from becoming reactivated. As we get older and our immune system starts to wane a bit, or if we have a medical illness, some type of chemotherapy for cancer, if you're on large dose steroids for some other medical purpose, you can suppress somebody's immunity enough that the virus then reactivates and it'll come right out that nerve root. So you usually get a band of a rash that kind of looks like chickenpox, but it's usually in a particular defined location along a nerve root, and it is very, very uncomfortable, painful, and in the worst case, again, the process will sometimes just run its course. The rash will go away, but the nerve will remain painful for months and months. So it can be really quite debilitating in the sense that the rash, even if it goes away, may not be associated with completely relieving the pain in that nerve where the virus has been. So the current shingles vaccination is basically a chickenpox vaccination, and it's basically a way of giving primarily adults a booster against reactivating the chickenpox virus. So individuals who are over the age of 60 are currently the target group, because the incidence of shingles actually goes up with age after 60, again, thought to be associated with just waning immunity. But in fact, anybody can get shingles if they've had exposure to the chickenpox virus in the past. And so we occasionally see, you know, young people or otherwise, you know, healthy adults who occasionally break out with shingles, but it's much more common in the elderly patients. And that particular complication of having that persistent nerve pain is one of the major reasons why people would want to think about having the vaccination to prevent that.
Okay. But the standard recommendation now is at age 60, not 60. Before 60.
Right. Generally based on the statistical likelihood of having shingles, it's relatively low below that age. Not impossible, just not very common.
And here, again, this is one of these things we've talked about before, but what does anybody think the fact that now kids are vaccinated against chickenpox means for the likelihood that some of them later in life will get shingles?
They still can because they've been exposed to the virus. There is a current recommendation for kids to get a second chickenpox vaccination. It used to be just one, and it was primarily to ensure active immunity against that. We'll simply have to wait for these kids to get older to see how well that protects them against shingles in the future. But in all likelihood, when they hit 60, they'll probably be advised to get that booster.
So even if they were vaccinated as children, as was recommended, that probably when it gets to that point, we'll say, yeah, let's give you another shot just to, you know, because it can be real unpleasant. You don't, if you can avoid having shingles, you really want to.
The caller asked about efficacy, and he was correct. It's probably about 50% helpful in terms of preventing recurrent shingles. And that's not quite as good as some other vaccinations who have higher efficacy rates, but 50% is better than zero.
And for those people who have had it, you talked about the fact that once that you have that initial stage where you have that characteristic rash and pain, once the rash goes away, it can still be very painful along that nerve continues to be.
Right. What's called post-herpetic neuralgia is the term given to that, and it can be really quite debilitating and very difficult to treat. What we refer to as neuropathic pain, the pain that's coming directly from an irritated nerve, is very, very unpleasant, and there aren't a lot of good medications available for that. Mm. Plain old pain pills don't really seem to be terribly effective. The latest recommendations involve the use of medications that in many instances were originally prescribed for seizure disorders because they have their primary effect in terms of quieting irritated nerves, because that's where seizures kind of get started. Mm-hmm. So there's a number of medications like that have been used here and seem to be helpful.
What are the chances that if an individual has had an attack of shingles, that they then sometime, you know, some years down the road, it would happen again?
It can happen again. Statistically, it's not very common, but it's mm-hmm. definitely not impossible.
So if you have had shingles, does it help to get the vaccine?
Yes, it does. So if you had shingles and now are 60 and want to minimize your chances of getting it again, then yes, definitely getting vaccinated would be helpful.
Our guest in this hour focus is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family medicine physician at Carl in Urbana. We're talking about just general health issues, something that we do with him every other month. We call it Talk to the Family Doctor. That's the idea. If you have a healthcare question, can be for yourself, can be for someone in your family, can be for a grown-up, can be for kids, give us a call and he'll see if he can help you out. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And you can also send us an email if you would like to do that. And that is will-talk@illinois.edu.
Along the lines of immunization recommendations for adults, there has been, in the last few years, a recommendation for adults to get a booster on their pertussis vaccination. Pertussis is what commonly referred to as whooping cough. Mm-hmm. And was thought, again, to be just a childhood disease. But what has been learned is those initial immunizations in childhood do, in fact, wane. And it's currently recommended that adults get a pertussis booster. Since adults are supposed to be getting a tetanus booster every 10 years, generally speaking, as folks come in, we're trying to say, well, you're due for your tetanus booster anyway. You might as well get your pertussis vaccination at the same time. And they do make a combination so people don't have to get an extra shot. Mm-hmm. It's just that the shot would contain both their diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis boosters.
So the DPT that kids get now, it's been bundled up the same way, and adults are
there's an adult form of that called Adacel.
Here's someone to talk with next in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a short story to tell, and then I would like to hear the doctor's comments. There have been a lot of talk about the shingles vaccine, and one of the things I've noticed that it often doesn't mention that as one of the questionable situations for the shingles vaccine is with someone who is immunosuppressed. And I was in that situation. I was taking methotrexate, and communication wasn't really great between my rheumatologist and my general practitioner, my internist. And I got the shingles vaccine on the day, actually, that I was taking methotrexate, much to my rheumatologist's chagrin. And I had a really strong reaction since the shingles vaccine is a live virus vaccine. And then a few months after that, I had a bout of encephalitis, and I had seizures, and I had a number of problems develop that very likely came from the situation of having gotten the vaccine while I was immunosuppressed. So I just wanted to add that as a consideration that people might make, see what the doctor thinks. Thank you. I'll listen to his comments off air.
All right. Thank you.
The caller's point is very well taken in that each individual needs to discuss with their primary physician the relative indications and contraindications for not only vaccinations but any type of medication, because there will be times and particular situations where something should either not be given or it should be postponed until later. And the situation with a live virus vaccination is such that if, in fact, someone is immunosuppressed, the vaccination itself could potentially be a source of infection. Now, this is not true for killed viruses. Those are much safer to use. But in situations where you're using a live virus, another example being the inhaled flu vaccination given in the fall as opposed to the shot. Mm-hmm. The shot is a dead virus. The inhaled one is actually a partially live virus. And so in those particular settings, not giving them to immunosuppressed individuals is, in fact, appropriate. Mm-hmm.
Well, if the vaccination for shingles is a live, this is a live virus, is there any chance that you could get that, and then if you were around, so say, like a baby that hadn't had chickenpox and wasn't old enough to get vaccinated against chickenpox, could you then give the baby chickenpox?
In very special sets of circumstances, possibly.
Hmm. Okay. So it's not a huge thing to worry about, but you would just say, so don't worry, you know. Don't worry about that. If you've gotten the shot and you're meeting a new baby, it's okay.
Right.
All right. Cell phone here, line 4. Hello.
Hello. Yeah. I'm concerned about MRSA-type infections. I have a 14-year-old son. Even though I graduated with my last degree from University of Illinois 40 years ago, and I'm aware that they're concerned about this in active athletic competition. However, I had a boil on my back. I don't know exactly what from, playing soccer, who knows. Back a few years ago, a doctor gave me something. It's sort of cleaned up, but it's still there and still contains pus, and I squeezed it and it stinks like son of a gun. Should I get it checked out? Should I have it cultured?
Sir, what you're describing... Yeah, and obviously we're doing this over the radio, so I can't be 100% sure, but you've given a virtually classic description of somebody who has a sebaceous cyst. This is a blocked oil gland underneath the surface of the skin. It, in and of itself, is not an infectious process. They will sometimes become inflamed because that white malodorous substance, if it leaks underneath the surface of the skin, is chemically quite irritating. But the treatment for what you're describing is not an antibiotic, but it's actual surgical removal of the cyst itself, which is a relatively minor office procedure that can be done with just a little local anesthetic.
Well, you're very kind. I thank you much, sir.
And thank you. We're talking this morning in this hour of Focus with Dr. Jeff Swearingen. This is the program we call Talk to the Family Doctor. We'll have some more after a short break. This is Focus.
Think of Italy without the tomato. Unimaginable. But the tomato originated in South America. When Columbus crossed the Atlantic, the exchange of not only food, but animals, insects, and viruses among the continents transformed the world. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Charles C. Mann, author of 1493, Uncovering the New World Columbus Created. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting audiences to enjoy Krannert Uncorked, a weekly free wine tasting almost every Thursday at 5 p.m. in the lobby. More information is available at krannertcenter.com.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here during the week with 10 different topics. Tomorrow at 10, Sandy Mason will be with us for our monthly show on lawn and garden care, taking care of things that grow on the home landscape. Then also tomorrow in the 11 o'clock hour, we'll talk with archaeologist Carl Lippo from California State University at Long Beach about Easter Island and about a very different way of telling the story of Easter Island than we have heard. He writes about this in his book, The Statues That Walked, Unraveling the Mystery of Easter Island. That's tomorrow. We're here again weekday mornings from 10 until noon. You can get the schedule by going to the website, will.illinois.edu. And in this hour, our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family medicine doctor at Carl and Urbana. And every other month, he's here for the show. And we call to talk to the family doctor. And if you have questions, you can give us a call.
Just following up on that last caller's comment, he mentioned his son in athletics, and that's a very good special consideration regarding MRSA, which is if somebody has active skin lesions and they're participating, say, in wrestling, this is in fact something that could indeed be given to somebody else who comes in close contact with that. So there have been, you know, concerns about how contagious this is, and athletics is a special situation where people are, in fact, you know, restricted from participating until it clears up. But in general, say somebody has something on their abdomen or their back, if they're simply sitting in class with their shirt on, it's not going to leap off of them onto somebody else. So in that sense, they can still go to school. They're not, quote, contagious. But if you were literally physically grinding your skin against somebody else's, yes, it could potentially be contagious.
Okay. To another caller, this is someone in Champaign and line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Dr. Swearingen, a couple of things I would be curious about. Number one, if you would just briefly address a couple of good ways to encourage two physicians. A couple of phone calls ago, it was clear that two physicians treating someone really hadn't communicated very much. And finally, of course, that ends up in the patient's hands. But if you are anxious to encourage a couple of physicians to address something as part of a functioning unit, what can you say without sounding unpleasant or demanding that would maybe encourage them to be a little more supportive and sort of consult with one another via a phone call? And I know their time is really limited. And number two, when the red blood cell count is quite low, but there are plenty of cells, however, they're unusually small. Apparently it indicates some type of anemia, but I can't really figure out what yet. So if you might address that, that'd be great. I'm going to hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you.
I appreciate the caller's political correctness and delicacy in terms of getting physicians to try to communicate with each other, because I think all of us struggle with that at times. Ideally, the patient's primary physician is receiving regular information regarding the patient from any consulting physicians. And sometimes that is the case and that information is readily available, and there are other times when it's not. From the standpoint of being the patient, the very best thing I think that can be done here is to simply ask, are you aware of the fact that I'm seeing, you know, Dr. So-and-so for such-and-such, and they have prescribed, you know, X and Y and Z. I've been informed I should, you know, not do A, B, and C, or I should be doing, you know, D, E, and F. Are you aware of this? And is what you're planning on doing a problem with these other facts. If the patient themselves has all the information, the primary physician may be able to make a decision right there. If the patient says, you know, I think I'm on something, but I'm not quite sure what, then really at that point the primary physician needs to contact that consulting physician and say, okay, what's the situation here and is there any concern about proceeding with what I was planning on doing? Mm-hmm. And if that can be done directly, it's ideal. With the use of the electronic medical records, that's supposed to be something that can happen more readily. You don't have to interrupt somebody, you know, with a phone call. You can send them an electronic message, get back, and then contact the patient with the information. So simply asking the question, are you aware of, and going from there should be enough to trigger that. Ideally, a good consultant is always sending back information to the primary physician to keep them up to speed with whatever changes there may have been in that patient's medical management so that this type of thing doesn't occur.
Okay. And so the other question, and I hope that I understood this correct, that she was asking about a situation where with someone's red blood cells, whether where they, there were adequate numbers of them, but that they were small or somehow not what they should be, and is that some variety of anemia?
Yes. If your blood count is low, that's essentially what anemia is. You don't have as many red blood cells as you're supposed to, and the real question is why. Mm-hmm. So you're all trying to figure out why somebody's anemic so that ideally you can fix it. But the type of red blood cells that are seen in anemia can give you a clue as to why you're anemic. So the ones that are small sometimes tend to be the ones associated with iron deficiency, lead poisoning. There are a couple of other less common mm-hmm. entities. But what typically has happened, if you've lost blood somewhere and your body's trying to make more red blood cells and it doesn't have a lot of iron, it says, well, rather than making a couple of big normal ones, I'm going to make four or five little ones and hope that I can still carry enough oxygen around in my bloodstream that I won't become short of breath and, you know, hypoxic. So it's sort of a compensatory mechanism by the body to make as many red blood cells, even if they're not the normal size. Now, if you find out where the blood was lost and you stop that and you take some extra iron, your body will then start to make more normal sized red blood cells. And if you take some additional iron beyond that point, you will replete the stores of iron that you're supposed to have in your body. Mm-hmm. So in most instances, people who become anemic due to iron deficiency have pretty much exhausted their iron stores, either because they've lost blood in women of menstruating age. Menstrual blood loss is the most common cause for iron deficiency anemia. And in many instances, just regulating their cycles allows their blood count to normalize. In men who obviously aren't losing menstrual blood, the gastrointestinal tract is the most common place for them to have lost blood. So in those particular settings, we're thinking about, say, bleeding ulcers. Does somebody have a colon tumor? Do they have some sort of gastrointestinal blood loss that's causing them to be anemic? So there's usually some type of evaluation of why you're anemic, but the size of the cells can give you a clue as to what type of anemia it might be.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I hope that helps. Again, questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk at illinois.edu. If an individual was having gastric bleeding and if there was enough, the stools have a sort of a characteristic look.
Well, it depends on where the bleeding's occurring. If it occurs in the upper gastrointestinal tract, as that blood leaks into the intestines, it will become partially digested. And you get what is classically described as a black or tarry-looking stool, and that's partially digested blood, which if you test for it will show up, in fact, as being blood. Now, if the bleeding from the intestinal tract is low, say down in the lower part of the colon, it'll just come out as red-looking blood because there isn't any digestion taking place in that part of the colon. So in many instances, folks can tell you, you know, I'm either seeing bright red blood, in which case we know it's coming from the lower part of the intestinal tract, or they say, you know, gee, my stools are black and sort of tarry looking. And then we know it's coming from higher up because it's being partially digested.
Well, that's I guess the thing that I was wondering about is would it be possible that there could be some kind of gastric bleeding somewhere that would be significant and yet not have not show up somehow so that the individual would look and think, whoa, something's not right here, and maybe I should get that checked out.
The appearance of the stool is simply going to be dependent on how much blood is being passed through the intestinal tract. Mm-hmm. In many instances, patients are not aware at all of any change in their stools, and the amount of blood is not a large quantity at any given time, but it's sort of a steady trickle through the intestinal tract, which over time...
And that could be enough to throw you into anemia.
Yeah, but it will have occurred very slowly and very gradually, not acutely. It will have occurred over probably weeks to months. Hmm. And then those folks come in and say, you know, just for the last couple of months, I've just been sort of tired and run down. And, you know, if you look closely at them, you go, maybe you're a little pale. You check their blood count, and they turn out to be anemic, as opposed to the person who says, you know, 3 days ago I was fine, and now I've had tons of blood coming out the bottom, and I'm feeling bad. And that's somebody who's acutely anemic and is going to feel that because their body hasn't had a chance to adjust to that.
Okay. Well, again, we have about 10 minutes left. If you have questions for our guest, Dr. Jeff Swearingen, we can take general sorts of healthcare questions, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. One thing I wanted to touch on just again because of one of those things that we've talked about and also because now there has actually been a change from the folks who make Tylenol. There has been some concern about people taking too much of that particular drug, and probably the way most people know it is by that brand name. So I think that actually now they're on the package, they have cut back on the amount that they think it is safe to take in 24 hours.
Mm-hmm. Typically 4 grams of acetaminophen was thought to be the upper limit. Most folks are basically saying it probably shouldn't be more than 3 grams. And especially in situations where people aren't always aware of the fact that other medications also contain acetaminophen. So acetaminophen in conjunction with cold medications, sinus medications, back and body aches and pain medications often frequently have acetaminophen in there. So people inadvertently say, well, you know, I'm taking Tylenol for this, but I'm taking, you know, these other things as well. And then all of a sudden, it turns out that's an awful lot of acetaminophen. You throw that into somebody who then has some extra alcohol to drink, and suddenly your liver's not very happy at all. And in fact, acetaminophen toxicity is one of the leading causes for somebody needing an emergent liver transplant, because if you kill your liver, that's pretty much gone, and you got to replace it.
Okay. Well, again, questions are certainly welcome. Dr. Jess Warrington is a family medicine physician at Carl in Urbana, and if you want to talk about your health or someone in your family, you give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Anything else that's particularly happening over at your place? Or we're probably at that time of year when actually things are maybe a little bit, unless you're doing a lot of school.
A lot of school physical. we always sort of laugh about the emergency sports physical because somebody will show up in the office, you know, at 4:30. And
I must have this.
Yeah, because practice starts tonight. Tonight. No, literally.
That much of an emergency thing.
And okay. To digress a little bit, I was helping my nephew with baseball tryouts for a junior high baseball team, and one of the kids showed up, didn't have his physical form with him, and he left, came back in about 45 minutes. He'd gone to convenient care for an emergency sports physical. And came back and completed practice.
Okay. Well, what exactly? It must be relatively routine. What constitutes a sports physical?
The Illinois High School Association has a standard form which the parents have to fill out the history part of, and the physician has to do the physical part of, and then make a determination: is this somebody who's, you know, healthy enough to play sports? Okay. And fortunately, you know, the kids who are going out for sports, most of them are generally pretty healthy, so it's usually not a major problem unless something is found that nobody knew of.
Okay. All right, then let's talk with someone in Urbana. Line number one. Hello.
Yeah, hello there.
Yeah.
With chickens being raised commercially in factories of sorts, terramycin is one of the major keep them breathing type of things that's given to them. But I noticed that that arsenic is now added to stimulate the hunger. I remember that 50 years ago, arsenic was removed from beef cattle feed. Can you comment on the relationship between terramycin and penicillin, which gives you anaphylactic shock, and then the possibility of reintroducing arsenic into chicken feed?
Whoa. Okay. To start at the top here, I have no personal knowledge whatsoever about the use of arsenic in feed for animals, so I don't feel at all comfortable commenting on that because I just don't have any personal knowledge. Relative to the use of terramycin and other antibiotics that are commonly given to domestic animals that are being raised for basically food production, it is fairly common to use that. There are current recommendations from, I believe, the USDA on what is or isn't allowable, because there has been valid concerns raised about the possibility of essentially producing resistant bacteria, as we kind of alluded to before with MRSA. So this is an area that's undergoing really quite a bit of scrutiny. Part of the problem with domestic livestock production is that it's often done in confined areas for the sake of efficiency, but those confined animals are also more likely to spread disease from one to the other, and consequently the use of antibiotics are fairly common to try and prevent that.
Well, that's maybe leads to the question that in a situation like that, for example, you wouldn't want to create a situation where you were breeding antibiotic-resistant salmonella,
correct,
for example. And then that is something that could enter the food system and people could get sick. And we know that foodborne illness, salmonella, E. coli continue to be significant problems. But you could also have a problem with antibiotic resistance in bacteria that affect humans. And we're getting the resistance there because we're giving people more antibiotics than perhaps we should. So really, if you're thinking of the issue of antibiotic resistance and how that might affect bacteria that are, going to make people sick, which of those two things, where do you think is likely to be the bigger problem?
I would actually say that in the United States, antibiotics are overprescribed for people. The vast majority of relatively minor illnesses that people come down with most of the time are, in fact, viral. And giving an antibiotic in that particular situation doesn't make them better faster, other than maybe psychologically, because they think they're doing something for it. But in reality, most of those things are going to run their course, are going to be self-limited. And as long as people continue to ask for antibiotics sort of inappropriately, then we're going to run into more and more problems with antibiotic resistance. Yeah.
Well, there, though, the doctor has to write the prescription. So, you know, when someone's not feeling well and you have looked at them and you have made the determination that an antibiotic is not going to do anything for this person, and says, "Doc, I need this thing. Give this to me." So how do you try to explain to them, "Now, look, it's not going to help, and in fact, it's really not a good idea."
And there are physicians who will have that conversation, and there are other physicians who will say, "Okay, I'm going to get this guy out of the office. Here's your prescription." And that's sad to say, but it does in fact happen.
Okay, we'll get one more caller here at least. In Strasbourg, line one. Hello.
Yes, this is Mike. Got a question. When a person's having a bowel movement or defecating, if you get a strong spasm a second or two later after you've done that, up your spinal, you know, up the back of your spine and that, what would that indicate?
Exactly that. That is a muscle spasm in the sphincter, the muscular contraction that allows you to control voluntarily the passage of stool. It's essentially the equivalent of a Charlie horse. We've all sort of had the experience of our calf muscle tightening up, and we know how painful that can be. In that particular area in our calf, we recognize it as not being, you know, terribly serious. It's just uncomfortable. But you can actually have that occur in any muscle in the body, and in the rectal sphincter, that's not necessarily an unusual place for that to occur.
But that would radiate all the way up the spine?
It can. Now, if this is an ongoing issue for you and you're over the age of 50, you're supposed to be getting a routine colon examination periodically anyway, and I would certainly mention that to your physician. They can make sure that they take a good close look and make sure there's nothing else going on, but the spasm in itself is a relatively common benign occurrence.
Okay. Well, I've never had it clear up and down the spine, and I've had it a few times here recently, and it's a little disconcerting.
And if it's persistent, go get it checked out, because the best thing to do is to get it looked at.
All right. There, we're going to have to stop. We come to the end of the time with our thanks to Dr. Jeff Swearingen, and he's a family medicine physician from Carl in Urbana. He's with us every other month on a Monday for the show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. Thanks very much.
My pleasure, David.